This is Martin Lindstrom, author of Biology for a Coronavirus World. And you are listening to Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails.
Hello and welcome to this hopefully short-lived series that will be airing in addition to the weekly Marketing Book podcast interviews. I'm your host, Douglas Burdett, and my goal during this unusual time is to reconnect you with past guests on the Marketing Book podcast, share some ideas and inspiration, and maybe a much-needed laugh or two. I've interviewed over 200 authors on the show, and my plan is to continue this series until I either run out of authors or quarantine, whichever comes first. A word of warning, the host and guest may very likely be drinking cocktails during these conversations. I mean, come on. They are recorded during the cocktail hour. To find the show notes for each episode with pictures of each guest and links mentioned in their conversation, visit marketingbookcocktails.com. marketingbookcocktails.com. See what I did there? And if you'd like to join the conversation, email a voice recording to me at douglas@salesartillery.com, and I'll try to include it in a future episode. I'd love to hear from you. Otherwise, connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat. Martin Lindstrom, welcome to Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails. Where are you and how are you doing?
Well, I'm actually sitting upside down in Sydney, Australia right now. So as you're drinking your amazing cocktails, I'm drinking cocktails for my breakfast, which is new for me, I have to say.
So you don't normally have red wine for breakfast. Okay, well, there's a first time for everything. And so actually, as we record this, it's 9 o'clock New York time, and it's on Tuesday evening, and it's Wednesday morning where you are. So of course, we're naturally going to want to talk about the future, and who has a better insight into that than you right now? So I should remind listeners that it's been a while since you were on the podcast. You were episode 59, and I'm now up to about 280 episodes, and it was February 2016, and that's when we talked about your phenomenal book, Small Data, which I have since gone on to talk about in various presentations I've given, and I've taken you on many trips with me, Martin. And for those that don't know Martin, just a bit about him. He's Time Magazine has named Martin one of the world's 100 most influential people, and for 5 years running, Thinkers 50, the world's premier ranking resource of business icons, has selected Martin as one of the world's top 50 business thinkers. And he's a high-profile speaker and author of 7 New York Times best-selling books translated into 60 languages. So, Martin, I seem to recall that you travel, was it over 200 days a year in a normal year? Something like that?
Actually, it's even worse. 300 days back in the day.
I apologize, yes.
I've reached a state now where I hated TSA. I hated catering food. I hated anything to do with planes. And now I have a little screensaver on my computer showing TSA in full motion just to inject that every day, because I'm not flying at all right now. I'm stuck in Sydney.
Are you like a caged bird, not being able
totally.
Totally. Now, do you live part of the year in Australia, or did you just happen to be there when the quarantine hit?
I happened to be here when the quarantine hit. I actually went for a wedding. And the day after, all borders closed, and there's not a single plane leaving Australia right now. So I have not been able to leave for 6 weeks.
My goodness. And do you have a sense for when you might leave or where you might go when you can leave?
Yeah, I think I'll leave by the end of the month. You know, it's really crazy because, I mean, Australia is a continent, and there's literally not a single plane leaving right now. And whenever you go into Australia, everyone has to go through quarantine. They're basically locked into a hotel guarded by the military and the police 24/7 for 2 weeks until they're let go into the real world of Australia. So it gives you a sense of how protective Australia is. But also, on the other hand, there was zero deaths over the last 24 hours. And I think very few have infected. In fact, where I am in New South Wales, is zero infected now. So it's played off. One could wonder how long time they can do a quarantine with the rest of the world without being separated from the rest of the world, right?
Mm-hmm. So you had some time, you weren't traveling, and you've, in a certain way, you've come out with this mini book, which is you've reprised your biology book, and I should remind listeners that's spelled B-U-Y-ology. So take us back, tell us a bit about the book Biology, which is one of your bestsellers, and then what prompted you to want to write this, and you must have written in a real hurry.
Well, listen, Douglas, the story is, it happened in 2008, where I published the original Biology, and it really was based on the fact that most of the stuff you and I do every day is deeply irrational, and we just don't know it. And so I wanted to figure out what's going on, because when you ask consumers or people, for that sake, about any questions, we actually do lie to ourselves. And one of the key study elements reported in my biology book was the idea of why is Coca-Cola the biggest out of the two brands compared to Pepsi? And no one was able to answer it. But using fMRI, the study actually showed that people loved the taste of Pepsi, but when in those scans where they had the brain scanned and they could look into the brain, they literally were able to see that, in fact, people loved the taste of Pepsi, but as soon as it was revealed, it was actually a Pepsi they're drinking out of Coke. In fact, the brain changed its mind and it was overriding the taste preference center. And literally the consumers were saying, oh my God, I like Coke more. So we really literally are lying to ourselves all the time. We're just not aware of it. So I decided to do this project, and we scanned more than 2,000 consumers' brains using fMRI. And it was a fascinating project, $7 million project, and the result was Biology. So that was probably the first time the concept of neuromarketing was introduced, and the whole idea about us understanding our brain in a much closer way than we'd done previously.
Mm-hmm. And so you talk a good bit about the brain in biology for the coronavirus world, and I was wondering if you could explain to us. Let's start with this pandemic and the fears that are going on. I found that very interesting. What is the pandemic doing to our sense of fear? And I guess what fears are coming to the forefront?
Well, you have to remember that we are very primitive people. Monkeys, which have evolved over many years, and our reptile brain, which is really the base part of the brain, is still there. We just added a lot of new layers to it. But when push comes to shove, what's really driving us is an area in the brain called the amygdala. And the amygdala is the fear spot in our brain. And it really overrides almost anything else. It overrides any feelings you have, because this is your survival mechanism. And what has happened through the coronavirus period is really that the amygdala has been on overdrive. What happens is that we have plucked ourselves into a new reality where multiple fear factors have appeared. One, the fear of course, containing or getting this disease. Two, that people are dying around you. And three, what are the financial outlooks and will I survive? And they're all plucking straight into the brain. So remember, psychologists time after time have said that the most prominent, most fearful things which can happen in your life is if you're getting divorced, you lose your job, or someone you love is dying. Well, this is coming up to that range. So what we're seeing right now is that this is a conversation with the amygdala we're having right now. And once that happens, any rational behavior is out of the window. And basically everything we do every day is irrational. But let me just pause here for a second and put that into two other perspectives, which I think is fascinating. The first one is something with Antonio Damasio's discovered many years ago, and I'm writing a lot about that in the original book, Biology. He developed a concept called a somatic marker, spelled S-O-M-A-T-I-C, somatic marker. Somatic marker is something so dramatic you'll never forget it. And in fact, it's so dramatic that if you were to scan a person's brain, you actually can see that in the brain. Now, somatic marker is what 9/11 was all about. I'm sure you remember where you were, who you're together with, even who you called. Now, what we know today is that the COVID-19 is a somatic marker, a negative somatic marker. And what we also know is that once that happens, it will create a profound bookmark in our brain and will never really be the same again. So that plugs straight into fear. The second dimension is even scarier, if you could say that word. And that's one of the theories I'm talking a lot about in biology for coronavirus world, where I'm basically saying that there's two factors which have made this become as big as it is. And I wanna say one thing now, doctors, this is really important for me to say, both to you, but also to the listeners. What I'm saying right now is not in any disrespect to anyone out there who's either contained COVID-19 or the health workers or anyone. I even have friends and families which have been affected by this. But what is really fascinating when you put this in a different light is that when swine flu was happening many years ago, you actually would notice that 2 billion people were infected by the disease. 2 billion.
With a B.
It's with a B,
yeah.
2 billion. And those 203,000 people are dying the first year. Now, you and I have never really, I mean, I can't remember a panic like what we're seeing right now, if it makes sense. So my question, of course, is as a semi-philosopher here, why is this so much bigger? Yes, I know a lot of people are dying. Yes, I know there's a huge panic at the hospitals, and I so respect every second of that, of course. But how come we hardly remember that disease back in the days with 2 billion infected, and now we certainly remember COVID-19. Well, one of my theories is that, first of all, Hollywood has played a major role in this. I can't count the number of movies like Contagion or like all the James Bond movies for that sake, Rain. You have tons of different movies which are talking about a virus being spread around the world. And in many ways, we have built up a sense of fear in our brain for that particular scenario. Now, we do know from some of our brain studies that fear accumulates. And it means that if you are affected to multiple aspects of fear, it never really disappears from your brain. It is really stopped. It's like an ongoing disease growing. And what we know for a fact is that it doesn't have to be the same source or even the same topic. It actually accumulates even though it's multiple different topics. Think about it yourself. If you've had a burglary going into your home and while you're not there, or perhaps even when you're there, you will always feel that shadow in your mind whenever it's happening. And we know today that people even are fearful now when they walk on the street then, or when they're alone, even though it's nothing to do with the house. Now think about that metaphor for a second, and then think about the fact that we now know that fear accumulates. Now that leads me to the second thing, which really is the social media. And social media, without any doubt, has amplified this whole message to the extreme degree. And what we know today is, and we saw that in the election and all that stuff, that fear spreads much faster than anything else. Because, again, it's a survival mechanism. So that's the reason why we're so exposed for this stuff all the time. So the fact that we not only have experienced a 9/11 type of thing, a somatic marker, the fact that we're afraid of our jobs disappearing, the fact that we're afraid of being contaminated, and then on top of that, the fact that we are seeing an accumulation of fear, we've been exposed for trailers, so to speak, of what's going on now through 30 or 40 movies in Hollywood, by the way, all of them blockbusters, through many years, and then suddenly that scenario is playing out, means that we are in overdrive. We have panic scrollings, and we're reacting in a much more extreme degree. So my fear of what's going on right now is actually not the number of people dying, which is horrible, it's terrible, I don't need to tell you that. It's actually the ramifications, the outcome of this, where I think we will have a huge world going into depression. People which are not able to cope with this pressure on uncertainty. And we know that the biggest fear people have is the fear of the unknown. Well, that's where we are right now. So it's not just the actual disease, it's also the halo effect of it later on. And that's, of course, a lot of what I'm writing about in the Biology for a Coronavirus World, because I think people have to be aware of when you sell to people, when you interact with people, when you're together with your loved ones, whatever format it is, you're dealing with deeply irrational people, me included, by the way.
Right. Well, talk also about this fear of dying alone. I found that fascinating, and I hadn't expected it, but it made a lot of sense. And also how this lack of touch is playing a role in people's depression.
I think that when you watch television or you are online and you see these horrible scenarios where your parents are dying and you see it through a Zoom link, or a Skype connection, and it even freezes that moment where, I mean, these are the horrible scenarios of you lying there alone with a camera pointing at you and there's no one you can hold in your hand. I don't think we can get closer to fear than that. And I think as this has been amplified through the social media in a big degree, of course, and it's happening for sure, then I think people see that scenario. But that also plugs into the second part of your question, which is lack of touch. And touch, I don't think we're thinking a lot about the importance of touch, but let me put it into perspective. There's experiments done with rats, and there's two different sets of rats. There were one set of rats which were touched and fed every day, and there's a second control group of rats which were never touched for a month. And guess what the outcome was? The first set of rats learned faster, they were more happy, and by the way, they lived substantially longer. And what we know today is that there's a direct correlation between how much you touch and how happy you are, and with that also life expectancy on top of it. And that's the reason why in Japan they've done a lot of studies on it for the last two decades, concluding that the reason why people at elderly homes are dying as fast as they were in Japan was because they had no touch, because their loved ones simply did not see them anymore in real person. So they introduced, this is typical Japanese, of course. They introduced
here comes
these,
the robot joke.
Yeah, here comes the joke. They introduced these robot seals, right? Which is very fluffy and very nice to look at, but it's a robot and you can pet it and it spins and whatever it does, this seal. And life expectancy really was going up. And I'm not saying we all have to have a seal in our Amazon delivery tomorrow to survive this thing, even though it may be an idea. I'm saying this because the biggest organ we have is not our brain, but it's our tactile sensation, it's our skin. And that is completely being suppressed by the fact that we are in lockdown. We're not allowed to talk and touch or hug anyone. And probably that would be somewhat cut away from the future. And that means that we will have a huge degree of depression coming in, because we need to have this tactile stimulation, because it's part of who we are. It defines our stimulation of the brain. It's almost the same as a potted plant needs to have sun as well as water, or we cut away the sun now. So from a rational point of view, you and I are always stimulated through, you know, Skype and Zoom and Microsoft Teams and whatever we are on all the time.
And red wine for breakfast.
And red wine for breakfast, exactly. And what happens is that we, from an intellectual point of view, are really stimulated. But as I wrote in the book, I also am saying, I feel like I'm looking through a two-way mirror. I'm observing the world, but I never really participate in it. And I think that's really where we are right now. And I think that's the reason why a lot of people feel a sense of emptiness, or they feel a sense of depression, or they feel perhaps even that they don't sleep as well as they did in the past, or they're dropping more balls on the floor. It's almost like you can't motivate yourself. You have so many things you want to do on your to-do list. It's just like, oh my God, I don't have the energy for it, despite me having all the time in the world. And that is partly a reflection of the lack of touch.
Right. And you mentioned dropping balls, and I was fascinated when you wrote about a study that Roy Baumeister did, where it showed that laziness often correlates with exhaustion.
Yeah.
And I wasn't aware of how exhausted a lot of people might be, even though they might be at home and it might seem deceptive.
Yeah, well, it's a good point. And just to back you up, I'll tell you about the study in a second, but I just did a global call as part of Thinkers 50, which is this ranking of business thinkers around the world. And we did a live broadcast world 24 hours around the world with 24 of us talking about the future. And I did this survey where I asked all the participants, thousands of people around the world, how many of you feel exhausted right now being at home? And 56% said yes, I feel exhausted, and 52% said, I did feel I'm dropping more balls. I just don't know why. So this is true. So why? Well, if you go back to Roy's study, he basically gave people an option to either eat radish in a nice bowl, or another part of the group had to eat beautiful freshly baked chocolate chip cookies. Now, I know what camp I belong to. That's the latter one for sure. But sadly, the first group had no choice. They were giving those radish. They're put into a lab. And then, of course, these sneaky scientists were sneaking out of the room, pretending like they wouldn't see anything. Of course, they had a camera hanging there in the world. And guess what? The radish eaters were really stubborn. They did not touch these beautiful chocolate chip cookies at all. And by the way, just so you know, for the record, that the chocolate chip cookie eaters, they did not touch the radish at all. So they were pretty nice people, well-behaved. But and that was really the experiment. But what they didn't know was there was a part two to the experiment. And people were there given a questionnaire or a sort of a memory puzzle. And they had to fill it out by connecting dots. And what they didn't know was it was basically impossible to solve this puzzle. But what was really fascinating was that the chocolate chip cookie eaters, they actually spent almost 18 minutes before they gave up, whereas the radish owners spent around 89 minutes and then they gave up. And what the conclusion from Roy's experiment was really fascinating, because what he said was, the fact that you had to spend so much time controlling yourself actually meant that you were exhausted in the end of the day and you gave up. And those radish eaters, they basically had to control themselves more than anything else, and therefore they gave up much faster. And I think that's really what we're experiencing right now, that we have to spend an enormous amount of brain power controlling ourselves, whether that is to clean that doorknob or whether we can't shake anyone's in their hands and come with endless excuses for why we can't do it, feeling stupid at the same time, or why you have to back away from a beautiful girl standing just next to you, 6 feet, and with all sorts of excuses, trying to pretend like you don't want to offend her, and actually you don't want to offend her, but you use all this energy on basically trying to wrap politeness around you, and we are exhausted. In the end of the day, we are subconsciously. Why? Because you and I are basically executing more than 350 routines or rituals every day. And that's everything from how you wake up, turn around in your bed, turn on your shower, brush your teeth with the right hand, in the shower, whatever you do. And more than half of those are now out of the window. And we're redesigning those rituals. And that really requires an enormous energy. And so that is the reason why when you work with consumer psychology today, I think it's super important for you to be aware of that you and I on the surface look really normal and happy and cheery and whatever, but behind the scene, the 85%, which really is our subconscious behavior and what we do every day, is in a mess at the moment. And that's what I concluded the first time when I wrote Biology in 2008, and it's the continuation I'm exploring a little bit in the Biology for Coronavirus Worldwide.
It brought to mind the importance of getting a routine. I'll hear all these people advise that when you're suddenly working from home or working virtually, that it's important that you have a routine. And in your book, you talked about how with all these rituals gone, we're actually having to work so much harder. And it's so it's that's interesting. But let's look ahead. You know, in the beginning of the book, you talked about how big events like the Depression affected an entire generation. I know both my parents, they were born in the early 20s. They grew up in the Depression. You know, they were of age in World War II. And I knew exactly what you were talking about how that entire generation was affected by that. You talk about how there's a similar thing that's going to happen here. And what are some of the changes? In fact, you mentioned that you think that the pandemic has a fantastic silver lining.
Well, I think it has for multiple reasons. But I think the first point I want to say is that, yes, I think every generation will have to go through a negative somatic marker, referring back to what Antonio Damasio invented back in the days. And by that, I mean World War I, II, and now this COVID-19. And I do think that that defines each generation. And as it defines each generation, I think what's happened is that we're profoundly changing our behavior. And we have in marketing speak a term which I'm using, which is called entry points. Entry points is really different doors into your life. And I believe on average, we have 7 entry points in our lives. And the first entry point is when you go to school. That's back to school. The second one is probably when you are leaving school, third one when you leave home, the third one is, or fourth one is when you get your girlfriend or your boyfriend, or when you get your first baby, or when you retire. So you have these entry points. And what we know today is that as soon as you go into an entry point door, through that door, you basically open up your eyes and you see things you never saw before. That's the reason why you see all those baby strollers the moment your wife or yourself or whoever it is pregnant, that you suddenly see things, you remove your filter and install a new filter, and that becomes thicker and thicker. Now, this is crazy, but we actually have now added an eighth entry point into our lives. Never happened before to this degree, except it happened in Second World War, where our parents were saving the food for the day after. They were using the Christmas paper 200 times over 10 decades. All that stuff, always switching off the light, and the next generation kind of thought that was silly and stupid and didn't really understand them. Well, guess what? Now we got that eighth entry point into our brains, and it really will define or redefine us. So I think that's sort of just to put it into that format. But in terms of the silver lining, I think there are some positive things coming out of this, at least I choose to say so. I think, first of all, what we realize is that as we sit behind those screens, we become increasingly out of balance. And that's what I'm talking about in my book, Small Data, that if you pick up small data, which I define as seemingly insignificant observations you make throughout your life, they also indicate you being out of balance or imbalance. So, for example, I feel overweight, I'm out of balance, I want to have a product for that. I feel alone, I'm out of balance, I have a self-esteem problem, I have Tony Robbins for that, whatever it is, right? So we're all out of balance in one way or another. Now, what happens is when we sit behind the screen, we are out of balance, that's because of the touch and all that stuff. But there is another dimension happening here, which I find is equally fascinating, and that is that we, as we sit there behind our screen, suddenly realize that in fact we've had too much of all those screens. And I saw that the other day when I was walking around in the area where I stay in Sydney, that the kids were suddenly playing on the streets. I haven't seen that ever since I moved here. And
without,
by the way,
phones in their hands.
Without phones in their hands. And that was really stunning for me. And it was a very nice and comforting feeling. And when I say comfort, let me just jump off track here for just 30 seconds. Comforting is really one of the number one drivers we have at the moment. That's the reason why conventional brands, CPG brands, Kraft Heinz, Campbell's Soup, Kellogg's, are really booming right now, because people want to have comfort food in order to feel safe and basically go back to the reptile feeling, right? So back again to my other track now, that as I was walking down the street and I saw all that stuff, I realized that in fact, when I give you unlimited amount of chocolate cake, you can eat as much as you want day and night, 24/7, at some point you get to a stage where you say, I had enough, or at least I'm going to control it. We never really had that enough. We were obsessed with our screens. I think everyone loved it. We had our phones everywhere, in particular the younger generation. And I think for the first time ever, they got a shock. And they really realized, my God, if I had unlimited of that, something is happening where I feel empty inside. And out of that, a lot of things has happened, which is good. Not only do I think that people will have a more natural relationship with this phenomenon of screens, unless, of course, the employers are abusing it and realizing we all have to work from home in the rest of our life, but I think you can't build cultures around that, so I don't think it will happen. But the second thing, which is a spin-off of all this stuff of the world stopping here, is that nature is recovering at the moment. And we do see that, certainly I know I'm swimming in the sea every day and I can start to see the bottom of the sea. I haven't been able to do that ever in Sydney Harbour. I'm starting to see fish. I have, you know, beautiful birds in the backyard, all that stuff.
Or the pollution in Los Angeles.
Exactly. You know, the pollution in Los Angeles has dropped 51%, according to IQ Air, which have done this huge study around the world and basically it's dropped in almost every capital city in the world. And of course, we could discuss why that's happening. I personally think that the planet has been stretched too much, been on overdrive. Perhaps it's Mother Nature saying, hey, guys, you have to wake up. Who knows? But I think in the end of the day, the silver lining here is we're starting to see another part of life as a consequence of this. And I think we have to learn from that. I don't think we should just rush back into this rat race or mouse carousel or whatever it is we were living in the past. I think we should ask a fundamental question. What's my legacy? What is my purpose in life? What do I want to do differently, right?
And you argue that people are going to be thinking about that a lot more going forward, and that's a good thing.
I do argue that. I think people are doing it already now. I think a lot of people are using this opportunity to reposition themselves as a brand. I think a lot of people went into this perhaps a bit too obsessed with themselves. And I think a lot of people going out and the other and saying, hey, I were able to give to people. I was able to call people I didn't call, say I love you, and really go into another state, which I just didn't have time to do in the past. So I do actually think a lot of people will wake up. Is it the entire world doing it? No, it's not. It's never. But I actually do think a lot of people are going through that mindset at the moment. So I think I decide to choose to look at this as the glass is half full and not half empty. And that is the glass half full scenario. We actually will start to reflect and ask ourselves fundamental questions, which we really didn't have the time to do prior to COVID-19.
Yes, and it's almost like there's a big reset going on that people are taking advantage of to rethink why they were doing what they were doing and what was actually important to them. But also businesses seem to be taking a fresh look at a lot of things. And I'm hopeful that businesses are looking at what is the real problem or solution that we're providing to people to help them to rethink what they're doing. And there's an example of there was a restaurant in Sydney, I think, they're in Australia, and they almost on a dime, they determined what they should do differently. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a restaurant in Sydney called Bar M, which is this fancy, very modern Italian restaurant, which typically have 200 or 300 guests at any point in time, dining in this New York warehouse style format. And very popular, and literally in Australia, within 12 hours, all restaurants in Australia was asked to close down, and the only thing they were allowed to do was to do takeaway. Now, the owner, Paola Toppi, she actually turned on a dime with her husband, and they converted the whole thing into a supermarket. And I don't need to tell you, this is super difficult. I mean, you don't even have the product to sell them like that. But she literally converted everything with shelves and displays and live food stations into an amazing supermarket where people, all these regular guests, suddenly were eating or buying this stuff so they could cook themselves. And then she went on. She started, to take away deliveries, but she also did a lot of other things. She said, well, people at home, they want to have some hope. They want to have a positive moment, a highlight in the day. So she created takeaway cocktails in small bottles with funny, exotic names on. And she went even one step further. She actually developed a cocktail kit where there was the shaker, Boston's shaker, and everything around it. So you could create your own amazing cocktails. And then she started to create these day-by-day diaries about what food you should have. And then she started to create this kit where you could have free delivery to your old ones or your parents or the seniors, and they will have it with small love notes in it. So she continued on and on and on. And she had, I believe, 80 staff, and she still retained 20 staff in this supermarket. And what was fascinating is she still survives and thrives despite this crazy crisis where basically every other restaurant either just went down the delivery path or closed down. And I think this is Douglas, this is super important for me to say. Whenever I do transformation work with larger organizations around the world, I always ask everyone, how many of you like change? And most people raise their hands, right? And then the second question, I realized they don't get it, because everyone is afraid of the unknown, and change is all about unknown. And when push comes to shove, I would say less than 5 or 10% really like change. So when you are stuck in this situation, then you have to have one thing in mind. This is your wake-up call, as I think it was Gordon Gekko said in Wall Street, the movie. And I think the wake-up call is very simple. As Tim Lowe, which is the president of Lowe's Food, which is a mid-sized supermarket chain in the U.S., and one of the most successful ones, we worked with him for many years, transforming them. As he said to me, rightly so, on an interview the other day, for those people going into this storm and leaving the storm intact and haven't changed a thing, they never got the message. The message is, you have to fundamentally change. And if you fundamentally change, then you got the message and use it in a positive way. I think a lot of us are still sitting back there, clinging on to a business model, which we all deep inside know probably has collapsed. We just don't want to admit it. We don't want to realize it, and we have to change. And if we don't change, well, it's change or die. We all know the quote. So that is really, in essence, what it is. Now, let me just put it into another, just so you don't go into panic, all of you guys listening at the moment. Here's my advice to how to do it. If you are selling a product, and guess what? People do not have the money. I mean, with 30 million people plus in an unemployment state now in the US, a lot of people don't have the money. Or at least we think they don't have the money. In 2008, Hyundai, the car company, in fact, did something unusual, which I'll never forget, where the rest of the car industry were bailed up, most of them by the US government, because they tried to drop the prices, no one bought the cars. Hyundai went the opposite way. Now, that's a Korean company. And they basically said, let's do some research. And they realized through the research that people actually, the consumers actually had the money. They're just afraid of using them. So they introduced the Hyundai Assurance, which really is a guarantee that if you buy a car, a Hyundai car, and you lose your job within the next year, you can return your car, no questions asked, and they will refund all the money. And that meant that Hyundai was surviving. And in fact, they had double digits growth both in 2008 and 2009. And I met up with the new CEO back then. And I asked him how many cars were returned. And the answer was 5. And I think this is thought-provoking, right? Yeah. Because it gives you a sense of that it may be that the answer you get is due to you having a filter on your brain, which choose to see things the way you always seen it. Now, if you remove that filter and you're looking for the small data, the seemingly insignificant observations made out there in the real world, you actually will see a completely different layer of opportunities. That's what you have to plug into and rebuild your business plan around.
And you quoted Haruki Murakami.
That's right.
Who said, when you come out of the storm, you won't be the same person who walked in. That's what this storm's all about. So, Martin, I was able to download this ebook because I subscribed to your newsletter, which everyone should do, and it was free. Is it going to stay free?
Well, it's going to stay free for 72 hours, right?
Oh, I better get this on the air right away.
Yeah, for 72 hours, it's free of charge for everyone to download it right now. And I'll tell you the reason why I wrote this book. I wrote it because I have literally in the hundreds of people reaching out to me every day asking for advice, asking about what's going to happen with the consumer now, consumer spending, what's happening with my business, how do I survive this? And I mean, it's everyone from gardeners to huge companies, more or less in panic. So I decided, why don't I just write a book? So I sat down about a month ago and I wrote basically 5 or 6 pages every day. And it ended up with this pocketbook. And instead of me trying to piggyback on a crisis, which would be horrible, I said, well, listen, why don't I give it free of charge? So to everyone, so you can download it. And hopefully you can recognize some of the things I'm saying. And hopefully, from the bottom of my heart, I hope that everyone listening will get an advice or two you can use in your own business or if you're dealing with clients, for your clients. I think we're all in the same boat here. I think that's what's wonderful about this. If you had to look at it from a positive point of view, it's hard. But if you have, I think we all, when we write an email to each other, in the past you would say, how are you doing? Not expecting an answer. And now you say, I hope you're well in these difficult times. And you know that the other person is in just as much shit as you are, right? Mm-hmm. And I think we all feel on the same page. This is going to change later on. But from my point of view, I just wanted to talk to fellow people out there and give them my best advice at the moment.
Well, this is a really generous gift you've given to all your followers and listeners to the Marketing Book Podcast. And it's done something that listeners will know I hate to do, and that's think. And it's really got me thinking. And it was so interesting, and you've done a wonderful summary of some of the key points. But let me just ask one other question about your next book. Now, the Ministry of Common Sense was originally going to come out this summer of 2020, but it's been moved to 2021, January at this point. Now, in preparation for an interview we were going to have, I've read the book and absolutely loved it, and I want to talk about it, but I'm sworn to secrecy. So, yeah. Martin Lindstrom, what can you tell us? What can you tell us about the Ministry of Common Sense to just tide us over until next January?
Ministry of Common Sense is a book about exactly that, that common sense is gone in our world. And it's gone in the world in every different aspect of life. I'll give you an example from the quarantine situation in Australia where people are locked into hotel rooms. They're not allowed to walk outside, but they're not allowed to receive wines in the hotels as well. So the police basically would take the wine away because they don't want people to be drunk in the little room for the next 2 weeks. Yet that's the only thing they can do. That's stupidity. Stupidity is happening everywhere in our world right now. And it's becoming, believe me, with COVID-19, if you thought stupidity was happening because of 9/11 and we had to take off our shoes and things in small plastic bags, wait and see what will happen with air travel very soon. So I decided to write a book about stupidities and then actually clean up all the bureaucracy in organizations and come up with some very, very simple tools of how to do that. Because I think we all, when we come back to the offices, are sick and tired of this politics and bureaucracy and want to change that. And that's what the book is doing. And it's doing it hopefully in a very funny way. At least I had a great fun writing it back then.
It's a funny book. I mean, I was just laughing. Now, I have to be honest. Some of the things I was laughing at, I was laughing to keep from crying because some of the things you described in there are truly idiotic. But you also explain what leads to it. You know, there's a whole chapter. You could have called it this chapter has all the lawyer jokes, but you didn't. You're a much better writer than that. but it included all these things. And then, of course, it included solutions on what companies can be doing. And of course, I saw so much of it through a customer experience lens because it's just ruining the experience for customers. And you even talked about that in this Biology for Coronavirus book about how you were talking to the airlines and they were acting as if they were not going to be in business anymore. They weren't even answering the phone or they were hanging up on you.
Yeah, I don't understand why people are behaving the way they do. I do understand that we're all under tremendous pressure, not just you and I, but everyone. But what I don't understand is people are behaving like there's no world after tomorrow. And the consequence of this is that how are you going to survive once this whole thing is gone? I guarantee you will disappear. We just don't know when. But if I have – what I've learned through all sorts of research is when you are in need, you are most susceptible for input. And whether you lose a credit card or whether that your loved ones are dying around you or whatever it is. And that's where companies which have had a foothold in people's minds for many years to step up and say, you've been loyal to me, I'll be loyal back now. And then give people an extraordinary service, even though you lose money on it. So my advice in the biology book was really to say, skip your entire marketing budget. Just skip it. And use it on customer service and experience right now. And build a base which will be incredibly loyal and thankful for you forever. Because if you don't do that now, you'll never get this chance again. And you most likely will lose most of your customers once this thing is over, if you don't do it right.
I think people are going to have a very long memory.
Yeah, they are. Because I think I will not forget those airline companies. Now, I called Singapore Airlines, and they were fantastic. They pick up the phone. They help you. They have no rebooking fees. They're flexible. They're smiling, even though you know they are under a horrible pressure as an airline company, given the fact that they are not flying, basically, at the moment. Think about the pressure they have internally. Yet they were smiling. And then, as I'm writing about in the biology book, Qantas did not even know they pick up the phone and they hang up on you. And I know that American Airlines and United and whatever is exactly the same. They are just repeating this one more time, that history, cheating passengers in odd ways on the aircraft and packing it as much as they can, even though the no passengers don't want to sit next to each other and all that stuff. They just don't have empathy in this. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Well, at least they're being consistent, Martin. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah. Well, that's true.
Brand consistency. That's right.
Yeah.
So, well, Martin, I look forward to reconnecting with you later in 2020 to interview you properly about the Ministry of Common Sense. And in the meantime, I really appreciate the opportunity to catch up with you and talk about this new pocketbook that you've done. And I appreciate you coming on Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails. Cheers.
Cheers for you and cheers for health.